From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The public is on edge, especially the Democratic half of the public, wondering if, when, or how the Bush administration will exploit the threat of terrorist attack in the race for the presidency. Many point to the recent orange alert, suspiciously timed, they say, to coincide with the Democratic convention. There certainly is circumstantial evidence to back the claim of political engineering, but no incontrovertible smoking gun, no document or on-the-record highly placed source to prove it. And there may never be.
The media are in a difficult position. When the political pitch is obvious, as when Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge praised the president's leadership when issuing his orange alert, newspapers all but ignored that part of his statement at first. Then, after a few days, some editorial pages did cite it as contributing, at the very least, to the appearance of a political motive. Should the media ignore these cues to avoid the charge of bias, or should they note them as a legitimate part of the story? We have an upcoming case in point, and we leave it to you, the listener, to observe how the government and the media play it in the weeks to come. On September 9th, Tom Ridge will announce the beginning of National Preparedness Month. That's a month-long slate of activities designed to promote public awareness. Here's the take of Bob Harris, writing in a blog called ThisModernWorld.com.
Why September 9th? That's awfully late if it's supposed to be the entire month. My guess, thinking like Karl Rove, this year's 9/11 anniversary falls on a Saturday, so an announcement on the date, or even Friday before, would only get a burst of free media on a weekend. Now, by timing it for the 6 p.m. news on Thursday, it reaches the Friday papers, and thus becomes fully injected into all the emotion-laden anniversary coverage, plus the Sunday morning talk shows.
Bob Harris joins us now. Bob, what's the matter with a public awareness campaign? We've reported on this program that the government hasn't done enough to educate the public in the ways that it can protect itself in the event of disaster.
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with a public awareness campaign in and of itself. There's something terribly wrong with the timing. If America needs a National Preparedness Month, gosh, it only took 3 years to come around to one after 9/11. And it's happening conveniently enough shortly before the election. Gosh, that's not hard to put together, is it?
Okay, but aren't you making a little more of this than you should? Congress declared February National Cancer Prevention Month. That doesn't mean they weren't actively endorsing cancer prevention all along.
No, not at all. At the same time, we do need to be prepared, absolutely. But this is an administration which has a record of politicizing virtually anything that they can, often at a great cost to national security. I would point out, for example, the New Republic reporting a month before the Democratic convention that they had three sources in Pakistani intelligence who said that the Bush administration was pressuring them to make a high-level al-Qaeda capture timed specifically to take headlines away from the Democratic convention. Sure enough, just hours before Kerry's speech, there was a major headline. We have a major arrest in Pakistan. Although it turned out, if you read closely, that the arrest actually took place 5 days earlier.
Okay, but what do you make of the fact that congressmen and women from both sides of the aisle are helping to kick off the month and governors from every state are taking part in the local events?
Well, what politician wants to be seen in an election year as potentially not interested in security? To point out the obvious political content of this is to run the risk of being called, quite dishonestly, uninterested in American security, when in fact all you want to do is try to avoid the politicization of stuff. Speaking specifically to the members of Congress who are participating and lending their names to this, I can't help but notice that the Democratic senator who's involved is Joseph Lieberman. He's the guy who proposed Homeland Security in the first place. He wasn't probably a very hard sell.
Well, what do you think about the role of the media in all of this? You predict that the media will play into the hands of the political machinations and help to give the Republicans a post-convention boost by playing up their strongest issue, the war on terrorism. You really think journalists are so easily duped?
You were president of the United States prior to the war in Iraq, weren't you? I mean, if you saw television any time in the last several years, you might have heard that, like, Iraq was tied to al-Qaeda, or possibly that weapons of mass destruction were rampant in Iraq, that our announcement of such could be in the form of a mushroom cloud, breathless headlines. We have a media full of mea culpas right now. We have the New York Times saying, gosh, we blew it on the war in Iraq. They wouldn't name Judith Miller particularly, but they did say, gosh, we really blew it on the WMDs. The Washington Post just issued a mea culpa saying, golly, we had all sorts of information that we sat on and didn't report, and we failed you. And now they're refusing to look deeper again.
I still think you're tossing off the idea that national preparedness is purely politics. What if it is partly politics, but it's also genuine public education?
Well, that's certainly the case. Absolutely. And I think it's extremely important that we become prepared properly by fighting Al-Qaeda, for example. I don't want to get blown up any more than anybody else. I just also don't like politicians who manipulate that fear to try to use it against me.
Bob, when it comes to the so-called war on terrorism and homeland security issues, is there anything the government could do at this point that wouldn't make you doubt their motives?
That's actually a very fair question. You know, at this point, with the Bush administration in power, I think that would be almost impossible. And that's a shame.
All right. Bob, thank you very much.
All righty. My pleasure.
Bob Harris, TV scriptwriter, Jeopardy champion, and voiceover artist, posts his political observations on thismodernworld.com. We're joined now by Susan Neely, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So briefly, can you explain what National Preparedness Month is all about?
Well, it's really an opportunity for a lot of national organizations, all 50 governors, members of Congress, our department, to say to Americans, preparedness matters. Please take some time to do an emergency preparedness plan. It could save your life, your family's life, and help you if there's a crisis.
And you feel like the message up till now hasn't been adequately communicated?
Well, actually, we launched about a year and a half ago what's called the READY program. I'll put in a plug for our website, ready.gov. In that program, which we do with the Ad Council, which is the pro bono arm of the advertising industries, what we say is you need to have a family communication plan so you can get in touch with your family members should something happen. You need an emergency supply kit, and you need to have more information. But, you know, like seatbelt campaigns and things like that that took 20 years, to bear fruit, you know, you just keep building on that. So what we're going to be adding is a big push on business emergency preparedness. For anybody who's read the 9/11 Commission report, that is a strong recommendation they make. Those businesses in the World Trade Center on September 11th who had done evacuation drills, who had emergency plans in place, got their people out, and they saved lives. We'll also, like all good public education efforts, have information that's accessible to kids, and we're going to have a mascot who will, you know, help spread the message in the good tradition of Smokey the Bear and McGruff the Crime Dog.
Who's that going to be?
We have found that what kids really respond to is a cartoon character of an American Shepherd, a dog.
American Shepherd, is there?
It's
a German Shepherd. We know it, and you know it. The Homeland Security Agency just doesn't want to say that's what it is.
Oh, well, there's Australian Shepherds, there's German Shepherds, there's Belgian Shepherds. I mean, it's a cartoon.
Now, this is an election year, and so perhaps it's inevitable that anything the incumbent administration does will be cast by some as politically motivated. So I have to ask you, why declare National Preparedness Month on September 9th, right after the Republican convention, just a few days before the anniversary of September 11th?
Well, my goodness, if we stopped everything that was needed to be done in this country because someone worries it's for political purposes, that I think that would be unfortunate, not very sensible. We have to do our jobs, and we are pushing preparedness every day of the week. What National Preparedness Month does, in conjunction with the anniversary of September 11th, in conjunction with Back to School, in conjunction with people being aware of the heightened threat situation in this country, it just puts a punctuation mark on the public education efforts of the Red Cross and us and a lot of other groups that are ongoing.
But this is a public awareness campaign with a bunch of very planned events to be announced on September 9th. Why?
We, in coordination with the co-chairs of the launch on Capitol Hill, picked this week in particular because Congress will be back in session. But there will be things happening the week before put on by other states, other community groups. There will be things happening the week after and the week after that. And there will certainly be plenty of us who continue to worry about public education and preparedness long after September 30th. So it's a continuum of activity and announcements. If you take the time to study any of the effective campaigns that have changed behaviors and encouraged people to take action over the years, whether it's stopping smoking or not taking drugs or buckling up their seatbelts, they all work along these lines.
Obviously, Susan, you know where all these questions are coming from. There are a lot of questions raised after the Orange Alert, where Tom Ridge made specific reference to the leadership of George Bush, and critics felt that that was an unseemly display of politics in what should have been a plain and simple message of warning. Do you guys worry about that perception yourself, that the wording that is used to present these warnings will hurt the credibility of the office and the job you have to do?
We are very conscious of that. We absolutely take the point that we have to be scrupulous in the way that we present information because it needs to transcend the political process. With respect to what the secretary said in his statement, I mean, the reality is we got this information thanks to a lot of efforts internationally in the offensive war on terrorism, which is how we were able to get this kind of specific, detailed, credible intelligence that allowed action to be taken. So, you know, the facts are the facts.
The facts are facts, but Pakistani intelligence figures have been quoted now widely in the media saying that they were ordered by the White House to issue that information close to the Democratic Convention.
Well, I guess I'm not aware of those statements, so I can't comment on them. I can speak to the fact that I'm privy to the intelligence that was analyzed and formed the basis of the alert, and that was very real.
Everybody is watching to try and figure out what is real and what is being timed and planned in order to have a maximum impact for a reason other than national security.
Well, I guess that's the reality of anything that happens from a policy standpoint in this country during an election process, you know, regardless of what level of government you work in, and those are fair questions. It keeps us all honest. But going back to how we started this interview on Preparedness Month, this is a cause, if you will, that we and many others have been working on a long time, and it's a opportunity that we have in September and beyond to encourage people to prepare, and that's what that's all about.
Susan Neely, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Neely is an Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security.
Up next, the emergency broadcast system enters the digital age and what a mess you can make when you don't check the facts.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Most of us still remember the old weekly tests of the emergency broadcast system, that ungodly warning tone followed by the stern assurance, "This is only a test," which was a nice way to say, "No, the ICBMs are not on the way." In the post-Cold War era, though, nuclear war has been replaced in our nightmares and our preparedness planning by terror attacks and other localized emergencies. And so the FCC is planning its first major overhaul of the emergency alert system. Reporter Bill McConnell is writing about the story for the television industry trade magazine Broadcasting and Cable. Bill, welcome back to OTM.
Glad to be here.
Now, I see the emergency alert system at work occasionally when, let's say, a weather advisory crawls across the bottom of my screen saying tornadoes on the way. But FCC Chairman Michael Powell says that the system has, quote, fallen into disarray and needs major reform. What's he talking about? Why is it in disarray?
Well, the problems with the emergency alert system really became apparent on 9/11 when no emergency alert was activated in New York or nationally, and people began to question, why do we have this system, and is it really living up to its full potential?
Your latest story talks about a situation in San Diego and wildfires. Tell me about that.
Last summer, there were, as prone to be in Southern California, wildfires bearing down on San Diego County. And around 11 o'clock at night, the sheriff's department decided it was time to evacuate the communities that were in danger. But unfortunately, no one thought to notify the local broadcast stations to get them to send out an emergency alert for about another 4 hours till it was way too late and everybody had gone to bed. Unfortunately, tragically, really, 12 people died overnight, and maybe some of those lives could have been saved if warnings had gotten out a bit earlier.
Let's talk about the technical underpinnings of this project. I gather that digitization is central to it.
Exactly. That's one of the reasons the FCC is moving forward now. We have all these new technologies that have not been taken advantage of. One of them is the switch to digital television that will allow broadcasters to send an array of new types of programming out, including programming with interactive links. So it's conceivable you could receive an emergency alert over your new digital television set and then click on a link to get more information, such as if your community is being evacuated, what are the routes out of town that are being used? Why aren't we taking advantage of cell phone technology so that people could receive alerts wherever they are, especially when they're away from home? Another big problem is that a lot of times these disasters happen when people are in bed. We now have the technology that would allow your television, your radio, your cell phone to be activated and receive an alert even if it's turned off.
Whoa, as if guided by an occult hand?
Exactly right. It would be kind of startling, but that might be what you want. If there's a fire racing down on your community, or if there's been a train derailment and toxic fumes are boring down on your neighborhood.
2 or 3 months ago in Italy, the party of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi used cell phone messages to alert everybody to vote. What are the risks of this system being co-opted by a government, local or national, for the purposes of politics?
Right now, the agencies that are in control of these tend to be ones that are not political. We're talking about the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the National Weather Service, state and local emergency agencies, or the people who would kick in these services. But what some folks I've talked to have warned about is that if terrorists wanted to disrupt the message at the same time they were setting off a bomb, they could actually send their own emergency alert message and have that incorporated into the broadcaster system.
That has a sort of Dr. No quality to it, breaking into the world's TV broadcasts to announce your extortion demands.
To some extent, the FCC would agree with you. A lot of those kind of security concerns have not been addressed, and they've been considered kind of pie-in-the-sky sort of worries. But I think with this overhaul underway and with more attention being given to the terrorist element of the threat we face today, I think that's going to be taken a lot more seriously.
So how close are we to actually having the new system in place?
The FCC envisions new requirements on broadcasters that could be implemented almost right away, with them simply going out and buying a card that could be inserted into their EAS monitoring equipment. Then again, the ways to activate cell phones, ways to activate BlackBerries and other PDAs, maybe even PCs, getting digital televisions online with this, well, I think we're still a couple of years away.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bill McConnell is a senior writer for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine.
And now for a few of your letters. Our report on conflicts of interest in medical research and medical journals prompted several letters like this one from John Cartsonis, a family physician in Phoenix, Arizona. He wrote, "I really appreciated your excellent report on drug companies and their stealth marketing to physicians and the public. I'll use a transcript of this piece to dissuade my department from accepting drug company research money." And this from Joy Overstreet of Vancouver, Washington. "I saw this kind of industry-funded and vetted research in the early 80s when I was writing a dissertation on federal nutrition and tobacco policies. How innocent that now seems compared to the seemingly inextricable webs between the drug companies, researchers, physicians, PR flacks, and medical journals."
And we received a correction of sorts from Lynn Howard Early of the National Association for Public Health Policy. He writes that Dr. Richard Smith, editor of the British Medical Journal, when I interviewed him for the story, left that job on July 30th. Quote, "After a long career editorializing against conflicts of interest, Smith now assumes the post of chief executive officer of United Health Group's new European division." Early notes that UHG, with sales of about $28 billion in the United States, quote, "now hopes to turn a few quid at the expense of Britain's public health service, and has hired Simon Stevens, Prime Minister Blair's health minister, to oversee the operation. This power play," Early writes, "underscores the continuing slide down a very slippery slope." aptly described as the corporatization of medicine and the commodification of human life.
And this update, we've covered the New York Times' examination of its own coverage in the run-up to war. We've also noted that the Washington Post buried some of its most critical and prescient stories, many by Walter Pincus, in its back pages. On Thursday, Washington Post media reporter Howard Kurtz anatomized his paper's coverage prior to the invasion of Iraq and came to similar conclusions. Kurtz quotes executive editor Len Downey, who said, "We were so focused on trying to figure out what the administration was doing that we were not giving the same play to people who said it wouldn't be a good idea to go to war and were questioning the administration's rationale. Not enough of those stories were put on the front page. That was a mistake on my part."
Keep writing to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. A new poll conducted by the American Journalism Review and the First Amendment Center found that 61% of Americans agree that, quote, "the falsifying or making up of stories in the American news media is a widespread problem." That perception may have its roots in the widely reported malfeasance of people like Jason Blair, Jack Kelly, and Stephen Glass. But we think the problem is rarely caused by conscious lying. It's usually caused by carelessness. There's a joke among journalists that some stories are too good to check, some are too hard to check, but they have to be checked anyway. What follows are cautionary tales for both consumers and creators of media not to believe everything you read or even see.
The first involves book fraud, the now discredited true story of a young Jordanian woman murdered by her father because she dared to date a Christian. Norma Corey's account of her best friend's so-called honor killing was exposed as a hoax in the Sydney Morning Herald late last month. So what's wrong with Corey's story? Well, among other things, she can't prove she lived in Jordan during the time specified in the book. The Herald says she's lived most of her life in Chicago. Corey claims there are thousands of honor killings each year. Amnesty International recorded only 15 cases in Jordan in 2003. Meanwhile, her publishers, Simon & Schuster in the U.S. and Random House in the U.K., sift through the evidence she sent to back her story, and her sequel is set for release in November. Malcolm Knox is the Herald's literary editor, and he joins me on the line from Down Under. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Brooke.
So, you're the man who wrote the expose, literary editor turned gumshoe. What sent you sniffing after Norma Corey?
The concerns were initially raised inside Jordan, where the book was being held up for ridicule because it was clearly exaggerating and falsifying facts about honor killings, which really do exist. And women's activists were concerned about this book undermining their cause. It was published in January 2003, which, as we know, was a time when a lot of people were prepared to believe the worst of Arab Muslim men. And this was a book that tapped into that feeling.
So what is the smoking gun in your case against Corey?
Well, really, the smoking gun emerged when I visited Chicago last month and I met members of her family, and they identified her from photographs that I showed them, and I was able to identify her in photographs that they showed me of her growing up in Chicago. I also had quite a lot of documentary evidence, such as motor vehicle ownership, real estate transactions, and so on.
Now, you'd have to say, wouldn't you, that Simon & Schuster did a pretty crappy job of fact-checking?
They were prevented from really checking on her because she said people's lives were at risk in Jordan if they went and checked on her bona fides there. And, of course, they didn't know her real name in the USA. Probably where the publishers fell down was these concerns were first raised late in 2003, and all the publishers did was they went to Norma and they said, is this true or not? She said, my story's true. And that was the end of it for the publishers. So I think they did a crappy job at that point.
That's a touching display of faith in one's author.
Well, she was a very lucrative property for them. I have a good deal of sympathy for the publishers, because if they were checking this kind of story as thoroughly as, say, I did, they'd be doing nothing else. But she was a very, very clever customer. She knew what she was doing. And I think, you know, they were simply tricked in this case.
And as you say, the story carries a lot of political freight. It shows an ugly slice of life in an Islamic family, a culture that would sanction honor killings. So now that it seems that her book is wrong, it's not just a literary dust-up, it's a political bombshell.
Well, it is, and Norma Khoury did become something of a poster girl for columnists of the right who wanted to amplify her story into the general atmosphere of dehumanization of Arab Muslim men.
How often do you think frauds in the form of true stories are foisted on an innocent public?
I'd love to know, but I can say one thing, and that's that the incentive to do so is greater now in the publishing business than it has ever been before, because of the rise of non-fiction memoir as the hot genre within publishing at the moment.
What do you think the impact is over time of books being exposed as frauds?
You know, I don't know what the impact will be, because as we discussed before, if publishers really checked their authors rigorously, they might find that the whole business of publishing non-fiction books becomes less than financially viable. So I suspect there are going to be a lot of scratched heads and a lot of hand-wringing in the short term, but I am a little bit skeptical of how much publishers will do in the future to prevent this happening.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Malcolm Knox is the literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. And now we turn to our second cautionary tale, a video fraud, last weekend's execution shown round the world.
My name is Benjamin Vanford. I'm from San Francisco, California, 1510 Eddy Street. I have been offered for exchange with prisoners here in Iraq.
Back in May, some San Franciscan pranksters shot grainy footage of what we later learned was the wrong side of a dull vegetable knife sawing against a man's throat. That video languished on some file-sharing websites until last Saturday, when it appeared on an Arabic site that has posted videos of real terrorist beheadings. The Associated Press and some other news outlets picked it up and ran with it. But it came to a screeching halt when the AP woke up 22-year-old presumed victim Benjamin Vanderford to find out if he still had his head. He did, but many wonder if it's screwed on straight, since Ben and his friends sent the video into cyberspace explicitly to fake out the media. The AP was quickest to run the video and to expose the hoax. For the play-by-play, we turn to AP Deputy Managing Editor Tom Kent. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
So, although the video was first posted on the web months ago, it didn't come to the attention of the media until it showed up on an Islamic website known for posting terrorist communiques. How did the AP come to rely on this site for its news leads?
Well, this is one of the sites that we watch fairly closely. This Islamic Minbar site has had a lot of things in the past, statements by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. It had a video August 2nd of a Turkish hostage being killed. It's had statements by the organization that claimed responsibility for the Madrid attack. So it has been a site that has had a lot of authentic material on it.
Would you ever spike footage, even if you knew it was authenticated, because you suspected that you were being used?
When things get out there of this magnitude, it's hard to ignore them. You get accused of suppressing things, holding off. The world is so interconnected these days that it's difficult to try to isolate something. But at the same time, our correspondents in Baghdad, Cairo, throughout the Middle East, and indeed all around the world, spend as much time throwing things out as we do covering them. And we go out, sometimes at some peril to our lives, to check out these reports.
Now, for the first 90 minutes, the AP ran the story without the disclaimer that the tape couldn't be verified. Is there a reason why that happened, or was it just a screw-up?
Well, we went for about 30 minutes before we started putting in words like purportedly in the story. And that was our mistake. We have to put in those qualifiers until we can be sure of something ourselves.
You know, the people who conducted this little media experiment, as they call it, made an explicit effort to dupe news organizations. And in all fairness, this isn't the first hoax ever perpetrated on the media. Do you think it's fair to expect news organizations to guard against every such ruse?
This hoax, above all, has just reminded us of the need to hew to our own policies. We're going to scramble somebody, as we did in this case. We scrambled two people at about 4 a.m. in San Francisco, go out to this guy's house. We managed to get into his apartment building. We banged on the door, and we got him out of bed, and he sat there bare-chested, shrugging, sipping from a diet soda, and told us about the hoax. So we didn't just pick this up and let it sit. For what it's worth, we were the organization that did break the fact that it was a hoax.
That's true. But I think that, you know, in the current environment, as the public got fed falsehoods on everything from weapons of mass destruction to the rescue of Jessica Lynch, polls say they just trust us less and less. And do you think they're right to?
There's a greater amount of information floating around the whole world now than there ever was. I suppose that percentage-wise, there's going to be more false information in there. The only thing we can do is try to get to the bottom of it, as we did in this case.
It almost seems like stories like these come out by occult hand to embarrass the media. Just bad luck for the AP?
Well, you know, every organization faces a hoax now and then. We devote an awful lot of efforts to make sure that we handle it right.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tom Kent is Deputy Managing Editor for the Associated Press.
Coming up, a jury's life or death deliberation on television and journalism's equivalent of a secret handshake.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last year, Australian Sue Smethurst was stopped by immigration officers at LAX, questioned, handcuffed, body searched, held in a detention center for 15 hours, and then sent back on a long flight home. Was she plotting a terrorist attack? No, she was coming to interview Olivia Newton-John. But she lacked what is known as the information visa, or I visa. The law requiring I visas, which applies to journalists only, has long been on the books, but rarely enforced. The Committee to Protect Journalists and the American Society of Newspaper Editors, ASNE for short, say the detention and expulsion of some 20 journalists so far sends the wrong message to the world, and they've asked Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge to reconsider the policy. Kevin Goldberg, ASNE's legal counsel, says the I visa is an outdated relic of the Cold War.
Well, it has its origins in the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which in turn was part of the McCarran-Walter Act, something that a lot of people actually have called the precursor to the USA Patriot Act. Its purpose was basically to allow for greater surveillance of subversives entering the United States. The Department of Homeland Security only began enforcing the requirement for an I visa in the past 18 months, and it did not exactly trumpet the fact that it was going to start requiring these visas again, so nobody really knew what was going on.
There's also the practical matter of covering the news. It's virtually impossible to deploy journalists to the United States in a timely fashion when you're, you know, waiting X number of months for your I visa to be approved.
Those journalists have to first make an interview with the U.S. consulate overseas, attend that interview with a consular officer, and be approved. If a visa officer is having a bad day, he or she can simply deny your application, and you do not get to appeal that process. As I understand it right now, it is about a four-week waiting process from the time you ask for your interview until you get your documents to enter the United States.
Let's go right to a second horror story, that of Elena Lappin, a reporter from The Guardian in the United Kingdom.
Ms. Lappin committed the crime basically of being honest and admitting she was a journalist who was coming here to do some work. And for her efforts, she was handcuffed, detained, for about 48 hours and then summarily deported without any hearing.
Are we just whining about this? Is this a relatively small matter of complying with the immigration law? And, you know, why should anyone make a special exception for journalists just because they're journalists?
Well, I think the point is that the journalists are being specially accepted just because they're journalists. Any other citizen of one of the countries with whom the United States participates in the visa waiver program, 27 countries to be exact, is allowed to enter the United States for up to 90 days without obtaining a visa. So the point is that journalists are actually forced to do this.
It's also, I guess, worth observing that the journalists who have been denied admission are not coming in from North Korea and Cuba and Iran, but the friendliest countries.
Exactly. These are the countries that we expect to be able to travel to freely, and we expect their citizens to travel to the United States freely. What's really interesting is that the citizens of the countries participating in the visa waiver program that have otherwise been excluded from the use of the visa waiver are very defined classes, such as people with highly communicable diseases or criminals. And essentially what we're doing is lumping journalists into that same category.
Well, if this is just a case then of enforcing a long on the books but long since outdated law because we happen to be tightening security at all points of entry, isn't it a simple matter of changing the policy?
Well, that would be the easiest way to do it. And in fact, a bill has been introduced in Congress to do that, H.R. 4823, which was introduced by Representative Zoe Lofgren of California. It seems the most direct route to change this. But the problem also is a greater mindset in which we've seen discrimination against journalists in many areas.
What about the Bush administration? It could fix the problem pretty quickly, too, by simply having the Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, issue a memo to border agents saying, you know, back off.
In fact, the Department of Homeland Security did state a few weeks ago that journalists who were ignorant of the I visa requirement would be allowed one free entry into the United States. But the second time, that person would be arrested, cuffed, detained, deported. It's just an embarrassing situation for the United States government to see journalists treated as criminals when the only weapon they're wielding is a pen is quite scary.
Okay, well, Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Goldberg is legal counsel to the American Society of Newspaper Editors. He spoke to us from NPR studios in Washington. Now, another breakthrough in reality TV. Only, this is real reality. ABC's seven-part series, In the Jury Room, offers an unprecedented look inside the judicial process. The cameras follow prosecutors as they build their case, film confidential lawyer-client meetings. They're even inside the judges' chambers. But what really sets this series apart from regular court TV fare is that for the first time ever, the Ohio Supreme Court let producer Michael Bix set up cameras inside the jury room of a capital murder case and tape the often heart-wrenching deliberations therein. Others have attempted this, and they were all denied. The PBS show Frontline asked for access to a Texas murder trial, but was refused because the prosecutor said he believed jurors would be influenced by the presence of the cameras. The ABC series records six homicide trials and begins with the death penalty case of Mark Dusick. I asked producer Michael Bix if he noticed any posturing from his jurors.
In the case of the trial of Mark Dusick, where I went on for 3 weeks, I mean, you're coming back to the jury room on breaks with these cameras and microphones there. But by the time they get through the trial, they've already gotten used to the idea. And so by the time it gets to jury deliberations, they seem to be completely comfortable with it. I mean, the one time that you do notice it a little is during breaks. You know, somebody will make a joke about, do you think they like what I'm eating for lunch? Or something like that.
Well, don't those little moments of self-awareness give you pause? I mean, I have to keep reminding myself watching this thing that the jurors weren't voting someone off the island. There's a chilling moment when it comes to the decision between life imprisonment and the death penalty.
I'm stuck between the gurney and life.
Are you really?
Life without
where you are?
Life without parole and the gurney.
So where are you?
Life, I guess.
Put me down for life, because I'll feel better him thinking about what he did.
I want him to have 25 years.
And my vote would be death.
That's a wild moment. I mean, it's a funny thing because, I mean, these are ordinary citizens who are discussing something extraordinary. They take what they're doing incredibly seriously. I mean, this is not like Survivor. I mean, this is somebody's life.
It's certainly gripping television, and sometimes you want to gasp, and sometimes the moments are just positively absurd. The deliberations in the jury room at one point get just surreal when they finally reach a conclusion and cheer.
The verdict. We, the jury, in this case, do find the defendant, Mark Dusick, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of aggravated murder charged in count one of the indictment. Are we all on board?
Yes.
Guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Three cheers.
Right after the cheering, one of them breaks down crying. The rest of them realize that their response was completely inappropriate, and they give this woman who is completely distraught at the fact that she's found somebody guilty of murder, I mean, they all walk over and give her a big hug. Back to your question, does their awareness of the cameras a little bit give me pause? Slightly, but do I think that we had anything to do with that? No. I mean, it was an extremely contentious deliberation, and I think that they were relieved that it was over. I mean, the notion that sort of 11 people spontaneously erupted because there were remote control cameras there, I just don't buy.
Let's talk about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that tracking an object affects the path of that object. When PBS was refused access, the judge had said, okay, you can do this, but the prosecutor objected, saying that he thought that the camera's presence would alter the deliberations. Was he wrong?
We've now done 11 cases over our two series, and at the end of every single case, we sit down with the judge and the jurors and talk to them about whether they thought the cameras had any effect. And out of over 100 jurors, none of them have ever said that it does. And nor have the prosecutors or the defense lawyers or the defendant, nobody has come back and said, we have changed the outcome. I mean, the one thing that I always fall back on, because I have a huge concern about this. I mean, if I thought I was affecting the outcome or the system, my deal with everybody is I would stop.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we do business on the basis of our word. And I mean, that's what's carried us from state to state, from, you know, prosecutor's office to prosecutor's office. If I really thought that we were affecting the process, I'd have to stop. That's my agreement with them, and I wouldn't be able to live with myself. Yeah, really.
A common thread in the reviews I've read about in the jury room was that, yeah, it was compelling viewing, but the reviewers questioned what was gained by the experience. What does a viewer get from in the jury room that he wouldn't get from watching a few episodes of Law & Order?
Well, I mean, Law & Order, Law & Order is fiction. I mean, when you think about probably one of the most crucial parts of our democracy is the jury system. And there's probably no greater responsibility we give a citizen than to decide in a capital case whether somebody lives or dies. To witness how that happens and to expose the public to it, from where I sit, is a huge public service. And our commitment to this goes way beyond the shows. I mean, we are publishing on the internet the entire transcript of the jury deliberations. I mean, anybody can look at it. They can look at what we picked, what we didn't. And we're also making available the tapes of the complete deliberations to law schools.
It's clear that you're articulating the argument for such a program, its value as a civics lesson. But the other argument is that it reduces an essential process of jurisprudence to just another reality TV show.
I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for 21 years. There is a huge difference between reality television and what I do. I mean, what I do is the opposite of reality television. I mean, reality television basically manufactures a situation and then just sort of has fun watching people do it. We don't manufacture anything. I mean, we are old school, fly-on-the-wall documentaries. There's no correspondent. I mean, we just watch what happens.
Ultimately, the defendant in this case, Mark Dusick, is convicted of murder but spared the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Had he been condemned, were you prepared to deal with that?
Yes. I mean, you know, there's obviously the personal level, depending on where you believe in the death penalty. But separate from that, it wouldn't have made any difference to me. I'm there to document the process. Having said that, I take no shame in telling compelling stories. But there's a big difference between sort of a compelling story and exploiting the situation. I mean, we're not doing this for entertainment. We're doing this because we think it's important.
All right, Michael. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Michael Biggs is the producer of In the Jury Room, which airs on ABC. conspiracy theories about the press abound. It's a mouthpiece for the left. It's cowed by the right. It's under pressure from the administration. It's under the thumb of corporate interests. It's controlled by the Jews. But there is one insidious media conspiracy that has actually been documented. Journalists from all over the country secretly in league, as if guided by an occult hand to corrupt daily reporting with certain code words meaningful to the conspirators and to the conspirators alone. And one of them joins me now. He is Paul Greenberg, editorial page editor for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Paul, welcome to OTM.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are a member of a secret society, are you not?
Yes, and I suppose you are too, now that you have used the magic words.
Well, is that how you get into the society? You don't have to drink anybody's blood or anything like that.
I think one of the technical requirements is that the phrase, "it was as if an occult hand," appears in your copy. Technically, it should appear in your printed copy rather than on air, but in your case, I'm sure that I can move to make an exception.
Well, you'll have to speak to the membership committee. The phrase, "as if moved by an occult hand." First of all, how often have you used that phrase in your copy, and for heaven's sake, why?
Well, it just comes upon me now and then. It originated when a group of rather bored reporters wondered how they could get some sort of telltale phrase past the copy editors, and they settled on "as if by an occult hand."
It has been in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. It's been in the Boston Globe 9 times from 1987 to the year 2000. Is it that funny a gag that reporters from coast to coast are getting involved in this little conspiracy?
I'm not sure if it's a gag, but it's more like a signal. And what it signals to those in the know, such as we are, is that one of our fellows has struck again. And it's also interesting to see with what artistry he has managed to slip in the phrase. Because if it's done amateurishly, the phrase will stand out. It will indeed stop the reader or the copy desk.
In December of 1975, a copy editor at the Boston Globe blew the order's cover in a page one story that brought some attention to this private society of yours. And the editors of that paper, and evidently of others, forbade the use of the phrase. Do you think they'll ever kill it off?
I don't know. It might go into hiding for a while, but it's much easier to keep up with the use of the phrase now that we have these search engines. But even so, I would think that some uses of the phrase would escape even our modern technology. In a way, it's a kind of assertion of individualism.
Like being in the Hells Angels, only better wardrobe.
If you had seen some of the newspaper reporters I have, I'm not sure about that last assertion, but yes.
Now, I don't want to be accused of making too much of this, but to the extent that people believe that there are sinister forces out there that are guiding the American press as if by an occult hand, doesn't the presence of the order of the occult hand just feed their paranoia?
Mr. Garfield, I think you are making too much of this.
So now that you've been publicly identified and, in fact, confessed in a column in your own newspaper, are you going to have to, by terms of your membership in the society, do something desperate? Resignation, suicide?
Maybe a general declaration of pointlessness and a reorganization. I myself think we are in sad need of another phrase.
Well, then let's open it up to our listeners for suggestions. If you think you have a phrase that can replace "as if guided by an occult hand," let us know. You can reach us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. Paul Greenberg, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Paul Greenberg is editorial page editor of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, where, as if guided by an occult hand, he... No, I'm not going to do that. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Derek John, and edited as if by an occult hand. And by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Vuolo. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.